and welcome to the Ship Energy Podcast. This is Mark Williams, broadcasting to you from Cambridgeshire in the UK. And my guest for this episode is Paul Stewart Smith, who's the managing partner at a firm of sustainability consultants called JS Global Advisory, based in London in the UK. Paul's a former executive director at the Baltic Exchange, where he led its regulated subsidiary between 2009 and 2017. Before that, he held roles in capital markets at Morgan Stanley and at Chemical Bank in London and New York. As a consultant, he's advised the Climate Bonds Initiative on its shipping criteria, advised a UK bank on structuring and rollout of a groundbreaking green finance product based on green bond and green loan principles and the EU taxonomy. Paul works with listed companies across sectors and geographies, with a particular focus on decarbonisation, the energy transition, and corporate reporting of climate-related risk in line with the TCFD recommendations, including scenario analysis and selection and reporting of key performance indicators. He's also worked on the new global biodiversity standard, which aims to provide much needed assurance to carbon sequestration projects and carbon credit markets worldwide. He's an Oxford educated mathematician, was trained as a barrister and served in the British Army. So this is a polymath and an all-round sustainability expert. So let's go and hear what he has to say about where we're up to on decarbonisation. Paul, welcome to the podcast. Good to have you on.
Hello, Mark. A real pleasure to be with you.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you to say so. So for those of our audience who haven't come across you in one of your myriad careers, please perhaps could you introduce yourself?
Well, thank you, Mark. I am the managing partner of JS Global Advisory. We are sustainability consultants, and most of our work involves providing advice to corporate clients on sustainability strategy and ESG reporting, with a particular focus on the energy sector and on nature and climate-related risk and opportunity. Before transitioning into sustainability 6 years ago, I was at the Baltic Exchange for 8 years, where I set up and ran its regulated subsidiary known as Baltex. And before joining the Baltic, I'd spent about 2 decades in financial services, starting out at Morgan Stanley, where I traded government bonds and derivatives. Along the way, I've also trained as a barrister, and at the start of my career, served as an infantry officer in the British Armed Forces for 4 years. So one of the good things about the work we do as sustainability consultants is that it draws on so much of my previous experience, as well as allowing me to be involved, at least in a small way, in addressing some of the world's most critical challenges.
So quite broad experience and related to shipping with your time at the Baltic Exchange as well. But what was it that caused you to make that transition to sustainability?
Well, I have a long-standing concern about many of the issues which fall under the heading of sustainability, particularly on the environment, but also human rights. And I felt that with the experience that I had had in over the course of my career, and not least at the Baltic Exchange, in actual fact, where a lot of my focus was on financial regulation, that was a good platform to then move into getting involved in some of the issues that I had been concerned about for so long.
I see. And one of the issues, the one that we are most concerned about at Ship Energy, of course, is decarbonisation. And I wanted to get your view on something. It seems to me that investment in alternative fuels is slowing down. There's been, you know, various news recently about Maersk perhaps is going to look at LNG rather than methanol for its next series of new building container ships. Shell has recently announced that it's going to slow construction of a biofuel plant in Rotterdam. I think BP has made similar announcements. Of course, if Donald Trump wins the presidential elections in the US, then, you know, he's already said he's going to support oil and gas over renewables. So I was wondering, you know, what's your take on this? Is decarbonisation getting further away from us?
Well, let me answer it this way. I think, first of all, that we will decarbonise the global economy because we have to. The impacts of climate change have become ever more apparent. Temperatures around the world keep setting new records, and almost every day brings news of another destructive and extreme weather event made worse or more likely because of global warming. Necessity is the parent of invention, as a saying goes. But whether we will achieve net zero in time to limit temperature rise to 1.5 degrees C or not is another matter. Based on current national and international climate policies, the world's leading climate scientists expect global temperatures to rise at least 2.5 degrees C in the coming decades. However, despite the negative news stories that you just cited in your question, I'm hopeful that we are, in fact, about to see a renewed acceleration of efforts to decarbonize. The world has just gone through two very difficult years following the COVID pandemic and the Russian invasion of Ukraine, both of which serve to distract governments and companies and individuals to some extent from the urgency of tackling climate change. But the vast majority of people are concerned that not enough is being done. So an Oxford University and United Nations Development Programme survey recently found that 80% of the people surveyed, and they surveyed 73,000 people in 77 countries, but 80% of those people wanted to see their governments take stronger action to tackle the climate crisis, and 86% wanted to see their countries set aside geopolitical differences and work together on climate change. So in terms of renewable energy and alternative fuels, yes, we do need a lot more investment, particularly for maritime and aviation and other hard to decarbonize sectors of the economy. But a huge amount of investment is, of course, already occurring. And according to the International Energy Agency, who reports in June, they found that global investment in clean energy technology and infrastructure is on course to hit $2 trillion this year. So that includes money for renewables such as wind and solar, for EVs, for nuclear power, for electricity grids, and for low emission fuels and heat pumps. Nevertheless, the IEA also forecasts that $1 trillion will be invested in coal, oil, and gas this year. And the fact is, of course, that instead of falling, demand for oil and coal both rose last year, in the case of oil, to just above 100 million barrels per day for the first time, according to figures from the Energy Institute. So fossil fuels still account for 80% of the primary energy mix globally, although in Europe, this is now below 70% for the first time since the Industrial Revolution. So a lot more needs to be done, and quickly, to scale up renewables. You mentioned Shell, for example, but I cannot comment on the specifics of their decision to delay producing biofuel in Rotterdam. And BP also appeared to be backpedaling on some of their renewable energy plans. In general, it would, of course, be really good to see if the oil majors, or if the oil majors could, in fact, figure out a way of using a greater share of free cash flow to diversify their businesses away from oil and gas production and into production of alternative fuels. Some will do this successfully, others may not, and end up returning cash to shareholders or with unusual stranded assets on the balance sheets. What is certain, though, in my opinion, is that to ensure that decarbonisation does not become a pipe dream, it is that further support from government is needed, both on the investment side in order to underwrite some of the risks, but just as importantly, by providing greater strategic and regulatory clarity. And that requires leadership. My final point is that in terms of leadership, I'm pleased to say that in the UK, we're already seeing some of this from the new government, with strong commitments to decarbonise the electricity supply by 2030 and the establishment of a national wealth fund to catalyse investment into the infrastructure and technology needed to support development of a low carbon economy and, as the government hopes, turn the UK into a clean energy superpower.
Well, turn the UK into a clean energy superpower would be great. The superpower at the moment, obviously, is China, where you know more than 80% of the world's photovoltaic cells are built, and yet the US and Western governments, like the European Union, are sort of setting out on a trade war with China, and the Americans have slapped, I think, 60% tariffs on Chinese photovoltaic cells. So surely we should be taking advantage of this very cheap technology to festoon every available surface with it.
Well, of course, as ever, it's a question of striking the right balance. So on the one hand, yes, cheaper goods from abroad, whether it's in solar panels or in goods in general, has its attractions. On the other hand, of course, we want the domestic economy, whether it's here in the UK, where you and I are, Mark, or whether it's in the US, people want to see the domestic economy benefit from manufacturing, and particularly with new technologies such as renewable energies and alternative fuels. So there's a balance to be struck. And of course, we are in the midst of an increasingly heated debate about that. And no doubt, although I don't want to wade into talking about US politics at all, but no doubt as the election campaign continues, there will be increased discussion about, America First and protectionism in the US, and building on what in fact has already happened in terms of the tariffs that you mentioned and some of the policies from the current Biden administration in that respect.
Coming back to the energy companies, I mean, the government's one thing, but the energy companies might do more. And from what I understand, that's your core business at JS Advisory, is talking to energy companies. What kind of work are you doing? What examples have you got for how they can contribute to the energy transition?
Yes. Well, so we work with companies across sectors, as I mentioned, but in practice, we do find ourselves working with companies in the energy sector, including oil and gas, more than perhaps others. But so happy to provide you with two examples of our current and recent work. So firstly, we are at the moment working with one of the European companies at the forefront of developing small modular nuclear reactors, helping them to develop their approach to sustainability strategy and reporting. And as you know, nuclear power produced via SMRs is increasingly seen as having the potential to play a vital role in decarbonisation, including in the maritime industry, where SMRs are now being discussed as a possible transformational solution powering some of the world's largest vessels. So very interesting company to be involved with there. The second example I would give you is that we spent almost 18 months advising Nigeria's leading indigenous energy company on their sustainability strategy, including in particular on climate change risk. And one of the particularly interesting things about that assignment was that we had to develop a clear understanding of the local context in Nigeria, where they are balancing Nigeria's goal of achieving carbon neutrality by 2060 with a more immediate focus on meeting the energy needs of its growing population by using the country's abundant natural gas resources to generate electricity.
Great. So two good examples there. Does this mean then that the work you're doing leads you to be more optimistic about achieving decarbonisation of the global economy by mid-century? What about, if we go a little bit wider, about the wider ESG, environmental, social, governance theme, of which decarbonisation is a third? Seems to be a lot of pushback against ESG, you know, a lot of claims of greenwashing and investors have started, if we think about stock markets, investors have started to become wary of all the different ESG schemes out there and whether they actually mean it. What's your take on all of that?
Okay, well, just in terms of decarbonisation, by the way, Mark, I mean, I'm optimistic that the energy transition will continue and is continuing. Whether or not we'll achieve net zero or decarbonisation by mid-century is, of course, to be determined. And at the moment, we're not on track for that. But in terms of ESG, it's frankly a mixed picture. It's certainly true that ESG has been going through some growing pains over the past year or two. It has, as you suggest, suffered some pushback, some very vocal pushback, particularly in the United States, in Republican-leaning states such as Texas and Florida. At the same time, some of the apparent pushback has been for more positive reasons, such as the crackdown on greenwashing, which has forced some companies, particularly in the financial sector, to refine some of their more blasé and unsubstantiated ESG claims. But to put the idea of pushback against ESG in context, perhaps it would be useful to remind ourselves what we're talking about when we use the term ESG at the corporate level. And what we are talking about is a wide range of environmental, social, and governance issues related to a company's business activities and relationships, which can have an impact on the economy, on the environment, and on people. So this includes, under the E, things like pollution, disposal of waste, and usage of water. Under the S, the way the company treats its employees, diversity and discrimination in the workplace, and the company's impact on local communities in which it operates. And under the G, the way the company is organized, but also things like bribery and corruption. So I don't think there are many people, even those who are pushing back against ESG and decry it as perhaps being too woke, who would argue that companies shouldn't be paying attention to these things, that it doesn't matter whether a company is discharging chemicals or sewage into rivers or using slave labor in its supply chain, for example. And many of these things are quite rightly, of course, prohibited by law. So while there may have been some pushback, on the other hand, as the headline in one of the newsletters that I subscribed to reported last week, reports of the death of ESG are greatly exaggerated. At the individual corporate level, companies and many of their employees are spending a considerable amount of time thinking about ESG, collecting increasing amounts of ESG performance data, including, for example, now Scope 3 greenhouse gas emissions, and reporting in line with the various ESG frameworks, including a number of new ones intended to make ESG reporting more meaningful. So the EU's been at the forefront of this, of course, with the implementation of the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive and the European Sustainability Reporting Standards. But even in the US, the Securities and Exchange Commission has introduced its own climate disclosure rules. And in the UK, under the previous Conservative government, TCFD reporting was made mandatory and new sustainability reporting standards have been developed. So it's not just a matter of reporting. Measures have also been introduced which actually require companies to do more. A good example is also from the UK, where the biodiversity net gain legislation, which took effect in February, now requires developers and land managers to deliver a 10% improvement in the quality of a natural habitat than existed before development took place. Having said all of that, it remains to be seen whether the new reporting requirements really force companies to take more meaningful action to improve their own ESG performance, and whether or not this translates in any way to addressing critical issues such as climate change or biodiversity loss, where at the global level, we're clearly still not making enough progress.
I feel sorry for anyone who can only achieve a 9% biodiversity improvement on the project. I don't know how you quantify.
There are ways of ensuring they make the 10%, even if it's only through buying a credit from the government.
What extent do all these different ESG reporting requirements like TCFD penetrated shipping? It's a requirement for listed companies in certain jurisdictions, like in the US. But what about shipping, which is, you know, offshore, focused very much in the developing world? It doesn't really happen with listed companies. There are listed shipping companies, but the vast majority of the global fleet is still privately held.
Well, that's right, Mark. So perhaps it would be useful just to explain what we mean by TCFD for some of our listeners who may not be so familiar with that. So the world of ESG, like so many other areas of life, is full of acronyms, of which TCFD is one, and that is short for the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures. And the task force, the TCFD, was set up in 2015 alongside the signing of the Paris Agreement, with a mandate to develop a set of recommendations or a framework, if you prefer, which companies and other organizations would be able to use to identify the risks and opportunities they face from climate change, and then to report information about this in their annual reports. And in fact, my business partner, Jane Stevenson, was closely involved in the development of the TCFD recommendations. And those were published in 2017 and are now used by thousands of companies around the world. And perhaps one thing, important thing to note about the TCFD, though, is that the task force no longer exists. It was disbanded in October 2023, and its role in driving climate reporting was handed over to the IFRS Foundation, the body responsible for setting international accounting standards, and which now also oversees the development of sustainability reporting via the International Sustainability Standards Board. And you mentioned that TCFD reporting has become mandatory in some jurisdictions, and that is correct, and that includes New Zealand, Japan, Singapore, Brazil, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and as I mentioned before, the UK. In terms of penetration into the shipping world, TCFD reporting has been adopted by some of the larger international firms, particularly in Scandinavia and in Japan and some other parts of the world. And examples from a quick survey I did the other day on this include Maersk, Mitsui, OSC, NYK, Costco Shipping, and Swire Pacific. However, it is true that there seems to be a much larger number of shipping companies who have not yet adopted TCFD reporting, despite the fact that they are producing sustainability reports. But it's worth noting, I think, that although that a majority of the major clients of shipping companies, including all or most oil and gas companies, mining companies, consumer goods companies, they are producing TCFD-aligned climate reports, and they will increasingly be looking to companies in their supply chains particularly those involved in transporting their goods, to do so as well. So probably something more shipping companies should be paying attention to. But away from TCFD, something I have found interesting is the level of penetration into the shipping world of a much newer ESG framework known as TNFD, the Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosures. This is similar in concept to the TCFD and provides a framework for organizations to measure the risks, opportunities, dependencies, and impacts related to nature and biodiversity. It's an area that we have been closely involved in at JS Global over the past 12 months, where we've been advising on the development of the business model for an important new initiative known as the Global Biodiversity Standard. And this is an initiative which is designed to provide a transparent, standardized methodology for measuring and certifying the biodiversity impacts of land management projects such as tree planting, and which could potentially play an important role in providing assurance for carbon offsetting projects, amongst many other use cases. So the TNFD recommendations were only published last September, and for the moment are purely voluntary, but already more than 400 companies have signed up to be early adopters, and that includes MSC, Mitsui OSK, Kawasaki Kishin Kaisha, NYK, Odfgel, the ports of Lyttelton in New Zealand and Newcastle in Australia, and also other companies with a maritime connection such as Bunge, Anglo-American, Vale, Newmont Mining, and Drax. So I think this reflects the fact that biodiversity is now one of the most important topics for companies to grapple with, particularly since the signing of the Global Biodiversity Framework in Montreal in December 2022. And as people wake up to the fundamental importance of nature in its own right, as well as to human well-being, a healthy planet, and economic prosperity.
Look, I hadn't heard of this new one. We should just clarify for listeners, Mitsui OSK is Mitsui OSK.
Yes, I'm never quite sure how to pronounce that, or whether to articulate the letters or just to say OSK. But anyway, thank you for that.
Maybe some people say OSK. Anyway, so Mitsui. But yeah, listen, we're getting to the end of our time. It's good to hear of these new developments, and I hope that they can make a difference. But by and large, you're optimistic that despite recent announcements and election results in places like France and likely election results in places like the US, that decarbonisation isn't going to stop. If listeners want to fill in any gaps in their knowledge, like on this TNFD, how can they do that? What can you?
Yes. Okay. So the thing about ESG is that it evolves on an almost daily basis. So it's important to keep up to date with the latest developments. There is, of course, also a lot of publicly available information on the websites of the key framework providers and other organizations involved in the space. Having said that, of course, they can also get in touch directly with me, either via LinkedIn or by email to paul@jsglobaladvisory.com. And I would be delighted to hear from them, of course, and see if we can help them with any ESG requirements that they have.
Super. Thank you very much. That's great. Paul, thank you very much for taking the time to come on the podcast. Appreciate you doing that. And thank you to everybody out there in listener land for tuning in. Trust you are enjoying your summer if you're in the Northern Hemisphere. It's been a very rainy one in the UK, but finally the sun has come out this week. And join us next time for another edifying and educational and entertaining conversation with another decarbonisation expert. So for now, this is Mark Williams signing off from an unusually sunny Cambridgeshire in the UK.